Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Friday, August 7th, 2020. Producing from his home in the foothills of Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home north of New York City, where we still, Taylor, have no power. But through the good graces of our neighbors, Joe and Ruth DiMarzo, keeping everything intermittently charged, you're kind of proud that we got through this week because it's been a challenge.
Shout out to Joe and Ruth coming up clutch. We talked a little bit before we got on. Do you want to share how you've been keeping up with baseball this week?
Yeah. Old school transistor radio. Last night, I went out. We have a fire pit, went out there, stoked up some logs and just tried to pick up as many, bouncing airwaves as we could. You know, it's one thing to, you certainly have the ability to charge up your phone from time to time, but you don't want to like go through like a 4-hour segment and then wake up this morning and try to do a pod. I did a spot on KBO broadcast to get an OTL thing coming up. So you have to pick and choose your spots. So I'm relying on the radio, Taylor.
Just like old times, nothing better.
There we go. All right. Some news and notes for today. The Phillies and Marlins, as they've juggled the schedule to react to postponements earlier in this 60-game season, they will play 7 games in 5 days with the new schedule. And that series, Miami was already scheduled to Philadelphia for 4 games, September 10th through 13th. And that series has been extended to include a game on September 14th and doubleheaders in the midst of that. A really cool moment between the Toronto Blue Jays and Atlanta Braves last night. Nick Markakis, who opted out of the 2020 season on July 6th and then opted in, came to the plate in the bottom of the ninth inning.
Nick awaits the offering, and here it is from Font. This one's hit in the air to deep right field. This is back towards the chop house, sailing through the sky. It's gone!
Woo-hoo!
Nick Markakis makes it a walk-off here in Atlanta. A shooting star off the barrel of Nick Markakis' bat that ripped through the air out to the chop house, and the Braves beat the Blue Jays 4-3.
And Nick Markakis, who doesn't smile very much, had a huge smile as he crossed home plate. That from 680 The Fan. Phillies playing the Yankees, and the Phillies took control early.
And the pitch. Swung on, hit well. Left field. Going back on it, Gardner to the track. Nearing the wall. He jumps. He's out of room. It's gone. As JT Realmuto has homered for the second game in a row, his third of the year. It's a 3-run home run here in the bottom of the first inning. And the Phillies take a 3-0 lead.
Scott Fransky, Sports Radio 94 WIP. By the way, during the course of that game, a group of fans gathered behind the fence of Ashburn Alley, and they were blowing an air horn when Yankees starter Jordan Montgomery was making his pitches. Aaron Boone, the Yankees manager, asked the umpires about it, but the umpires were like, hey, it's outside the ballpark, no recourse. And so that was maybe a factor during the course of that game. Angels and Mariners and Shohei Ohtani, who will only hit the rest of the year, did exactly that for the Angels in the top of the second.
And here's a high fly ball. It's hit well out into left field, out by the wall, and that one's out of here. It got over the wall. Ohtani the opposite way. D. Gordon was jumping up at the wall, and that one got over the wall. Ohtani's third home run of the season, and the Angels have a 1-0 lead.
Harry Smith, Angels Radio, AM 830. Oakland playing the Rangers, and Oakland took a lead early.
1-2 pitch. Line back up the middle, a base hit. Laureano's around third. He'll come home and score without a throw. Mark Canna delivers his 8th run batted in and doubles the A's lead to 2-0.
That from the Oakland Athletics radio network. Kevin Newman came through for the Pirates.
Didn't get past him like it did John Casey, though.
That one up the middle and through. Tucker is in with the tying run. Here comes Reynolds. He will score. And Mr. Walkoff does it again. Kevin Newman is the hero. And the Bucks walk-off winners today.
Yeah, Kevin Newman, who's had 5 walk-off hits in his relatively short career. Pretty amazing. Today, we're going to be talking with Hannah Kaiser of Yahoo, Todd Radom. The chief executive of our weekly quiz will join us. We'll talk about the ballpark in Texas. And we're also going to be talking with Steve Gelbs of SNY because this weekend will be the rollout of our E60 on Pete Alonso. I actually had a .com piece that posted today. I'm on ESPN Daily also on that podcast talking more specifically about the Pete Alonso piece, which again will broadcast on Sunday, August 9th at 5 p.m. Eastern time. Here's a preview clip from that E60 piece.
He was the biggest kid in the room, and he was the funniest. He was the biggest kid in the room, and he was the funniest, the kindest, and he was always goofy, but he was made fun of throughout his childhood for his size.
Everyone kind of goes through their kind of like stage in life, like awkward stage, if you will. I was bigger. I was picked on for it, but I mean, that kind of stuff really stuck with me, and it hurt on the inside. Baseball was my safe place. Someone can make fun of me in the classroom or like or in PE or whatever, but no one would make fun of me in between the lines.
Here we go, that's gone.
That was my outlet. That's when I got my payback. Because then like, yeah, you're making fun of me, like I'll just hit a homer off you. Suck on that.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code BASEBALL. That's code BASEBALL. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
For the ones who get it done, Grainger offers high-quality supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as access to product specialists who have the knowledge and experience to answer your toughest questions. Plus, their commitment to being your safety partner can help you keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call. Click Grainger.com. Or just stop by.
Steve Gelbs covers the Mets for SNY. Steve, good to talk with you again.
Buster, good to talk to you, man.
All right. So I get asked this question all the time now when I do radio about the Mets and about Pete Alonso. What's wrong with him? You know, we're about a dozen games into the season. He's hitting 180. He's got 20 strikeouts and 50 bats and one extra base hit. And I just kind of, you know, initially I'm like, look, it's a small sample size. No one would care about 12 games if it were 162 game season as much. And he also reminds me of a player that I covered back in the day when I was at the New York Times, Paul O'Neill, where I get the feeling that Pete can drive himself a little bit crazy because he has a very high standard for himself and, you know, drives himself. And Paul O'Neill was the same way, where just every at bat was wrenching. tell me what you're seeing in Mr. Alonso.
Yeah, I think your comparison is really spot on. He's someone who puts more pressure on himself to succeed than anybody else on the outside ever would. And this was, you know, one of the questions going into this season is after having a rookie year like that, how much pressure was he going to put on himself to somehow take a step forward when in all likelihood there was no way to do that. You were going to have some bit of regression. And we thought maybe in a 60 game season when all of a sudden, you know, you can't hit 53 home runs again, maybe that takes some pressure off, but I'm not so sure that's the case. I do think that, you know, this slow start has gotten to him and we've seen him express some frustration more than I think at any point a season ago. That's what's going on the mental side, but physically and mechanically, he is off right now. And Keith Hernandez actually did a great breakdown on this the other day on the broadcast. But, you know, then I spoke to some people with the team. And the biggest thing right now is if you look at Pete's at-bats from a year ago, he was really very short to the ball and did not have a big take back at all with his hands. Everything was quick, short, direct to the baseball. And now it seems like there's become a bit of a hitch. He's added a bit of a hitch where when he loads, he really does bring his hands up and then down. And so what that's causing is it's causing Pete to be underneath more balls than we're used to seeing. And so he's just missing. He's just underneath. And the one thing that, you know, is different about Pete Alonso than a lot of other big time home run hitters is he doesn't really hit these majestic shots so often. Most of what he does is hit really hard line drives. He'll often say, I'm a line drive hitter. It's just my line drives go farther. And that's because he's just short to the baseball. He's not really getting underneath things. And so right now, because he's underneath the ball, because he's not hitting those line drives as much, I think that's why you're seeing this slump, but it's something that he's aware of. They're working on it. And again, like you said, if it was a regular 162 game season, nobody really talks about it, but because we're already 20% finished with the year, it's a bit more urgent than it would be any other year.
So on Sunday, we've got an E60 profile of Pete that's going to air. I went down to Tampa to spend time with him in January. And look, I talked to him a few times last year and got a strong first impression from when I spoke to him. I feel like the word earnest was built for Pete Alonso. Like, what a sincerely nice person. I wrote an ESPN.com profile that's published today about Pete and a couple of his friends took us out on a boat and we went fishing. And his friend is a fishing guide. One of his friends is a fishing guide. And it was in this river just off the bay. And we must have caught 50 fish in like 2 hours. It was crazy how many fish we were pulling in. But what was so neat, you know, Pete, after he catches a couple fish, he's like handing out baited rods to everybody, right, to our cameraman, to our sound man, to me. And we just had this absolute blast. And then when we were done and the camera's off, Pete looks at our cameraman, at Logan, and he goes, "Did you have fun?" And then he looks at Greg, our sound man. He's like, "Did you have fun?" And he looks at me, "Did you have fun?" I mean, he's just a sincerely nice person.
He is one of a kind. And that sounds so much like Pete. You use the word earnest. I use the word genuine when I talk about him all the time. He is as genuine a person as I've met, period, let alone a person in the game. It's funny you mentioned the handing out the rods and then asking everybody if they had fun. You know, when we spoke to him right before or right as summer camp commenced via Zoom, at the end of it, he said, you know, "Hey, thanks, Pete." Yeah. He goes, "Real quick, guys, you know, so I know that it's different circumstances now, but are you guys happy to be back too? Are you happy to be back too?" And I mean, he genuinely, that's how he is. He cares about people and there's not a fake bone in his body. I remember I was speaking to one of his agents last year, just at the park one day. And I was, you know, mentioning this, how he just seems so real. And the agent said that there was one point, you know, when he became a pro and there was somebody who brought up, "Hey, maybe there should be some, you know, consultant that comes in and just works with him on how he talks to the media, because at times, you know, he can go on and he there's nothing that he says that he doesn't mean." And as you and I know, that's great for us, but at times, a lot of professional athletes don't want to act that way. They want to be a little more guarded. And what Pete said and what his agent said is, no, this is what makes this kid special, is he doesn't want to be, to think about things. He doesn't want to be fake in any regard. And I think it's really refreshing. It's really unique. You mentioned giving out the rods. The big story that I'll always take away from his first year, from his rookie season, is when, you know, he felt that, just like a lot of players on the Mets and the Yankees feel, that on 9/11, Major League Baseball should let them wear the first responders caps. And that's something that has been, you know, a bit of a fight for a while now. And so Pete found a way to get around that. And he went around to all of his teammates and got their cleat sizes and bought everybody custom made cleats for that night with, you know, the USA and the American flag and this and that on everybody's cleats. And that is something that it's so beyond to see a rookie do something like that, that it's just, it was special and it stood out and he didn't want any publicity for it. Somebody else had to tell me about it. He's just a truly one of a kind kid. And you know, all the success that he's gotten, he's someone that you just feel really, really genuinely happy for.
So the week before I sat down with him in Tampa for an interview, he was at his old middle school and there was a newspaper report about what he talked about, and it really jumped out at me because he spoke a lot to the kids about hey, you know, don't worry about being different. Don't worry about being weird. And, you know, it's just as a as someone reading that, I'm like, there's like something there. Like, you get the feeling like this is someone who got picked on when he was little. And I got to tell you, it was like sticking your finger in the ground when I asked him about it and then having an oil gusher come out. And it was the biggest surprise because he's the happiest person ever. He cherishes everything. But boy, is he mad about how he was treated by, you know, kids who called him fat when he was a kid, you know, by a high school coach who told him he never play in college. You know, the perception of scouts that he wasn't ever going to be a legitimate college player. He had an incident that he told me about that happened at the University of Florida with teammates when he grabbed a kid and stood up for himself for the first time, grabbed a kid off a scooter, and he told off his college coach in the dugout because he felt like that they were treating him badly. And of course, everything that's happened with his transition to first base, and you realize how driven he is by all that, that anger that he harbors.
He really, really does. And, you know, I have a theory that anybody that reaches that type of a level and that has this maniacal work ethic the way that Pete Alonso does, there is something internally that is impossible to quantify. And there's some reason why you just, they're pushing and pushing and pushing. And, you know, I feel this way about Jacob DeGrom. The other night when he went six innings, struck out 10 and walked one, and was furious with himself because he gave up two runs, even though he was up 7-0 at that point. He wants to be perfect, and he felt like he made a mistake, and it was just eating at him and gnawing at him. And that little bit of insight, when you see that, you realize, okay, that's why this guy has won back-to-back Cy Youngs. And I get that same feel from Pete with some of these stories that you mentioned. When I talked to him last year, he also told another story about being a freshman at the University of Florida.
Right.
And they make all freshmen take a class called The Good Life. And the purpose of it basically is to create, you know, if you could have your ideal life, what would that look like? And write a paper on this. And I would imagine that the theory is if you can start to visualize it, then that's what you go for. And Pete wrote that he was going to be a Major League Baseball player. And he got a C because, quote, it wasn't a realistic goal. And he still remembers that, and he's, you know, angry about that. And it was just another one of these, okay, all right, a little bit of motivation. You don't say I can, well, watch me. And the defense thing is, I mean, you're 100% right. If you bring up what scouts said, I brought up to him once, when it was clear that, you know, he was a better defender than anybody thought he would be. I said, you know, I once had a scout, Pete, that said he's one of the best hitters I've ever seen in the minors, but he's so bad at first base that he's going to get hit in the face with a baseball one day. And, you know, Pete didn't laugh it off. I can't remember what he said, but I remember he cursed. This was on camera. He was like, pardon me, but I'm going to curse, because he was just so still so bothered by that. And it has led him, truly, whatever the real motivation is, if that's the motivation, if that's what he needs, it has led him to take such a leap at first base that all of a sudden now, when he says, okay, I'm going to become an alchemist and I'm going to turn my leather glove into a gold glove, you believe him. You really do believe him. And so I wouldn't put anything past this kid, but it is definitely everything that you say, all the slights, everything. He is one of the nicest guys I've ever met in my life. But if you cross him or you tell him you can't, he's never going to forget that, and he's going to use it as fuel.
And here's a backstory on that teacher you referenced, University of Florida. We tracked that teacher down.
Really?
And I contacted the teacher, and I'm not going to I can't get into specifics out of respect for the teacher. And that teacher, I said, look, you know, this is something Pete Alonso, you know, he clearly uses ways to get himself motivated. We want to talk to you. And the teacher was like, yeah, okay, that sounds good. About 4 minutes later, I get a phone call. That teacher clearly had gone, Googled your piece, I'm sure that you did with him, and was like, I'm not talking with you. And there was like an anger with it. And I said, no, you got to look at it in the right perspective. Like, this is not really personal. This is just sort of how he drives himself. Nope, not doing anything on camera.
That is too funny. Yeah, you had to, because I remember we did it. It was part of a podcast interview that I did with Pete last year, and we put that little clip out, and Pete retweeted it with something about, again, about the motivation or never let anybody tell you you can't. And it just went, I think, you know, in like a day, it had 500,000 views, and everybody's like, you find this teacher. So I'm sure that teacher saw what you were talking about and wanted no part of it.
And by the way, had no idea. Didn't remember the paper, had no idea who Pete was. So it was totally innocent. You could see a teacher legitimately, okay, I got 500 kids in my class, you know, I get this paper back, and this guy wants to be a, you know, thinks he's a major leaguer. And then it was pretty funny. All right,
that's
Steve,
hilarious.
I appreciate your time on this. Thanks for helping me put him in perspective.
Hey, Buster, thanks so much. I look forward to seeing the piece. The clips that I've seen so far are fantastic.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish.
Yes, the clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, 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 with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit directtv.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hannah Kaiser covers baseball for Yahoo. Hannah, how you doing today?
I'm doing okay. I have power, so I'm definitely not complaining.
Yeah, you're in a better place than we are, for sure. Yesterday, when we were doing the show, I started at 20%, 18%, and I was watching the numbers tick down on my laptop and just moving the questions along. As you and I talk, I'm looking at 56%, so we're in good shape.
Okay, well, I talk very quickly. That's like my thing. So if you need me to speed it up, just you know, give me some sort of signal on the side. No, I'll talk real quick.
There you go. I enjoy your episodes of The Bandwagon, but I'm really curious because you have behind, as you tape those, you've got all this cool memorabilia, you got caps, and I'm curious about, from your perspective, what's the coolest part in your eyes of your collection?
Oh, wow. Okay, so you actually can't see, we're filming in my apartment, obviously, we're not in studio, and my producers had a bunch of the gear that we had in studio brought over to my home, which was nice of them. And they were like, where do you want to film? And we walked around and we're filming in front of what is actually like a wall of baseball memorabilia that my husband and I already had set up. And it's a shame because we don't have enough space in the room to get the camera far enough back that you can actually see all of my own memorabilia. So you're really only seeing stuff from the set. But I think you can see, this is like a weird self plug, but my parents had framed for me as a college graduation gift. I did a cover story for the Philadelphia Daily News on the Fanatic. I like knew the editor of the Daily News and I wrote it while I was still in college. And this was my journalism break. It really, really was. I did this. This was like the first published baseball story I ever did, was a profile of the Philly Fanatic that ran as the cover story of the Daily News. And we have that framed. I think you can see that in the shot of the show. And it's like memorabilia about me, which is like a really self-indulgent answer. But I just think it's such a funny, like people will say, like, what was your big journalism break? And I'm like, well, I did a profile of the Philly Fanatic. He and I went and did karaoke as part of that.
That sounds like it was a lot of fun. But my question is, you were doing that, and I've got more questions about your collection of memorabilia. But how do you do a profile on a mascot with that? Supposedly, I think the credo is they're not supposed to talk, right?
They're not supposed to talk. So it was a sort of dual profile of the mascot and the man in the mascot, which is why I think actually, if I remember it correctly, and I hope this part didn't get cut, the lead of the story was that Tom Burgoyne, who plays the Fanatic, and I went out and for an interview, and then we ended up at a bar and there was karaoke, so we did karaoke, and I wrote about how the most recognizable person in Philly did karaoke and no one knew it was him. And so it was really about the juxtaposition of being the Fanatic is probably truly the most recognizable figure in sports Philadelphia history. This was pre-Gritty. And so it was sort of about being famous and not being famous.
So when he would he honor when he had the costume on and you were around him, did he honor that? Or was there kind of for lack of a better way to describe it, on background conversations?
No, he was pretty good. He totally honored it. Although having done that story, now when I see the Fanatic, I'm like, the face is so obvious. I can't unsee it, which has really ruined the magic for me. I grew up watching the Fanatic and I spent 22 years being like, oh, I wonder, where's the guy in it? And then once I saw it up close, I was like, oh, now I see it all the time. And it's totally ruined the magic for me. Plus it smells so bad. The costume smells so bad. That's the other thing I'm always thinking about now when I see it.
Oh, absolutely. You bet. I mean, to wear something like that through the hot summer months, I'm sure. So getting back to your collection, when you were a kid, were you an autograph collector? Do you have anything like that or anything in particular? What was your big get?
Oh, my God. This is a great story. My big get is my parents took me to spring training in the 90s sometime. I wish I remembered exactly what year. I was like, I don't know, 8 or 9. So it'd been the end of the 90s. And I desperately wanted Phillies autographs and everything. And I bought, they were always selling in spring training, the broken bats that you can buy. And I had tons of guys signing it and they're all, sorry to these men, they're all nothing now. It's like a bunch of spring training dudes. I don't think I knew who I was getting to sign it then. And I desperately wanted Jimmy Rollins' autograph. And I was so sure. I was like, this is going to be the real one. I'm going to not put it on the bat with all these nothing guys. I'm going to have it on my hat. And he was so great. This is I've actually not met Jimmy Rollins since I've now become a baseball reporter. I would love to meet him and thank him. I was so determined. I waited. And he was like, if you stay after the game, they're running by and everything and doing stuff in spring training. And he said, if you stay after the game, I'll sign everything as much as you want. And so I did, I waited and he signed both the bat where I had all the generic signatures of men who went on to probably top out in AAA. And then I also have a Phillies hat and the only signature of the hat is Jimmy Rollins. And it was my prized possession my whole childhood. And I've never met him. So if you see him, tell him thank you for me.
Isn't that great when your heroes don't disappoint you? I had a story. One of my first big get as an autograph, I was 10 years old. Growing up in central Vermont, and our little league made a group trip up to Parc Jarry in Montreal. And a member of the Expos that year was Willie Davis. And I grew up a huge Dodgers fan. And he had been traded over the previous winter for Mike Marshall. And so I went there thinking I really want to get Willie Davis's autograph. But I was unbelievably shy and petrified as a kid. And I didn't know anything about sort of the autograph process. And so I'm just sitting there in my seat during the game, first inning, second inning, third inning, fourth inning. And I'm watching Willie run on and off the field. And I'm just like, I got to build up my courage to go try to get an autograph, not knowing the protocol, not knowing that during the game, you don't get autographs from players.
Well, that's not the right time.
No. Guess what? In the seventh inning, I finally built up the courage and I went racing down the bleacher seats that they had there. And we were just behind the Expos dugout. And as he stepped off the field into the dugout, I was just above him, sort of looming above him against a railing. And I was like, Mr. Davis, can I have your autograph? He stopped and signed the ball for me in the middle of the game. And that was the coolest thing ever. And as I turned around, there was this row of kids who were lining up behind me. And of course, an usher was like, hey, get away. No, no, no kids, no autographs today. But I got one in the middle of a game.
If that was captured on camera, that would be like in one of those really heartwarming commercials of like, we miss you fans. Yeah,
exactly. No,
that's a great story. That was, I think, it's funny because now that I like cover baseball, my parents are always like, do you remember that spring training we brought you to once? And I'm like, of course, Jimmy Rollins, that signature.
That's cool. All right. So we just got this these new ramped up protocol from Major League Baseball as they're trying to deal with the outbreaks that they had or responding to the outbreaks they had from the Marlins and the Cardinals. When you saw the new protocol, what'd you think?
All right. The very first thing that I thought was that one of the items in the protocol is like, hey, all these teams, you got to make sure you get us your team protocols. And I was like, did all the teams not already get you the team protocols? Did you notice that? It's like, it's the very first item. Changes to the protocols effective immediately. No later than tomorrow, August 6th, all clubs must submit to MLB, MLBPA, Joint Committee, a copy of their individual code of conduct that's required under Section 2.6 of the original operations manual. Have they not already done that? Because that would seem to be part of the problem. I don't know. I don't know if not all the teams hadn't done that, but that certainly stood out to me. The big thing that stands out to me is that, of course, you can make your protocols stricter and stricter. I just wonder how feasible it is. You know, it's sort of like if the protocol says like you can't do anything, that doesn't mean people aren't going to do anything. And I'm trying to balance sort of the fact that like these are grown men and everybody should be behaving as safely as possible with the fact that like they're just because you put it on a piece of paper and sent it out in a memo to everybody else doesn't really take into consideration whether or not like that's it doesn't seem like they've really the part that I worry about is like, okay, yes, if this all happens perfectly, that will be good. Do we think this will all happen perfectly?
Yeah, 1,200 people living like monks. It's going to be a challenge. And the other, you know, I was talking with Derek Gould on the podcast earlier in the week, and we were mentioning that, you know, these hall monitors, for lack of a better way to describe it, the health and safety protocol officers assigned to each of the teams, I mean, it really just comes down to how vigilant those guys are willing to be, right? I mean, when we had the hall monitors in high school, you had some who were a little aggressive and some who were more lax, and you probably knew you could get away with something. And I think the same thing is going to come down with the teams.
Yeah. I mean, so prior to these coming out, sort of when we knew they were going to come out and we had started to hear a little bit more from Rob Manfred about, what it was going to take to get the season back on track after the Marlins outbreak and the Cardinals outbreak. I spoke to Dr. Tess Wilkinson-Ryan, who's a University of Pennsylvania law school professor, and she studies psychology of moral decision-making. I spoke to her specifically because she had written this piece in The Atlantic that I think about constantly that's specific to the idea of, like, does mask shaming work? You see someone without a mask, should you shame them? And she wrote about how, like, all of the psychological studies that have been done and the way that they amount to essentially saying, like, the headline of that Atlantic piece is our minds are not equipped for this kind of reopening, that it's that, you know, people are worse at judging 6 feet from their friends than they are 6 feet from their from strangers, that people tend to overestimate the fact that there are individual that people tend to overestimate the fact that, well, I'm pretty healthy, so it probably won't affect me. It'll probably affect less healthy people. That, like, we really, that there is tons of literature that says just telling people how to behave is not, like, reliable, even if everyone is completely well-intentioned. And the example she gave when I spoke to her about baseball protocols, which I thought was, like, an incredibly compelling example, is that, like, you would never just tell people to go a safe speed limit on the highway. And you also would never just tell people to go the speed limit without putting speedometers in cars. Because even if you think, well, you know, the law is you will go to jail if you don't go a good speed, but if you don't give people speedometers, even if they're trying to make the right decisions, like, the stakes are so high and the possibility for, like, really dangerous and even fatal mistakes is so great that you'd be like, look, even if we wish everyone would behave smartly, we are going to have to facilitate this up to the point of handholding because we don't want there to be any really dangerous mistakes on a highway or within coronavirus. And that I thought about that a lot, is that like, it seems like these protocols are a little bit the equivalent of, now we have speed limits, but I don't know that we have speedometers. Like, I'm not sure now everyone knows, you know, exactly what they should be doing. But to your point, it really will come down to the individual team level, these hall monitors, and then also sort of, you know, managers and coaches, and how are they instructing people on a minute by minute basis to make sure that they know, like, even if they're well-intentioned, is someone reminding them to wear their mask? And is someone pointing out like that might not be 6 feet, and like that stuff, which sounds a little bit coddling, I understand, but it is important if you actually want it to work. It's sort of, of course it's a little bit handholdy, but maybe that's what it's going to take, because people have really proven, people in the society, people in communities, people have proven that nobody wants to get coronavirus. And yet people have not been great at figuring out how to protect themselves and everyone around them on their own.
And I wonder too, you know, having that stringent health and safety protocol every day is so antithetical to the experience that so many of these players are used to in their baseball lives, which is why I'm really concerned about a mass exodus of players, especially from those teams that are not playing well, that all of a sudden, yeah, you know, we get into late August and early September and guys are like, you know what, I'm out. I'm not that interested. You know, I reach my service time benchmark. I'm ready to move forward. And I don't want to have a life here for the next month where we have no chance to make the playoffs and I can't talk to anybody and I can't eat with anybody and I'm just going to sit in my hotel room. I'm gone. All right. You have the same concern?
Yeah. You mentioned the service time point, which was, I was going to mention if you didn't. I mean, was it George Springer yesterday? I think was it yesterday, hurt his wrist and,
yes.
X-rays are negative, but he could miss some time. And right, he already hit his service time. He was a guy who had his service time manipulated at the front end of his career, and now he has a chance to only play a couple of weeks and get that seventh final year that he needs to hit free agency. And right, if I'm George Springer, I'm like, yeah, I might just go home and not have to first of all, rehab as quickly as possible and have to ramp back up a third time this year if it takes him a few weeks to get healthy. But yeah, just opt out, man. Like, go home. You got your service time. You're going to be a free agent and come winter. And these protocols, it doesn't seem like something that's really worth working really hard to get back to.
No. And if I were one of his teammates, I'd say exactly what you just said. Like, hey, dude, get out of here. You don't owe us anything. You got your, you know, you got your service time in. You're eligible for free agency. You don't want to risk any, you know, serious injuries. You move forward and you go into free agency. So get out of here. I mentioned the bandwagon. Here you are talking about the playoff bubble. Give a listen to yourself.
It's officially undeniable that a bubble is the safest way to play sports this year. The COVID rates reported by the different leagues with their different strategies are clear and compelling. But then again, so are the different circumstances. Baseball is a behemoth that had an entire season left to play when the pandemic suspended all activities back in March. Asking 30 teams to isolate for months on end was deemed untenable, which makes a certain amount of sense. But what about 16 teams for a month-long tournament? The postseason should absolutely be played in a secure bubble. Put it in the Rangers' new stadium with the retractable roof, or put it in New York City, which has two parks and a better handle on coronavirus. Even if you could overlook the health ramifications, which you shouldn't, we've already seen how positive tests can wreak havoc on the competitive integrity of a series or a season. Juan Soto missed the Nationals' first 7 games while quarantining over what was suspected to be a false positive. And when more than one player tests positive, whole teams are sidelined, along with their opponents. There's a whole lot to unpack about how troubling these disruptions are, but in terms of playing an efficient postseason schedule, they're completely prohibitive. If MLB isn't already planning an October bubble, seriously, how else are they going to even attempt to crown a champion fairly? Now is the time to start.
And Hannah, I have one question about that. We got 1 minute left, but I wanted to ask you, it feels like it's different than the NBA and the NHL to me, just because they won't have the time to have that intake period. In other words, because the regular season is going to end on Sunday and they have 16 teams, they are going to fly into the postseason process. And that's the one question I have in terms of the practicality of it.
Well, they've already changed so much about this season. I mean, it really goes back to this idea, even the 60-game season and the idea that we have to do it in 66 games and we have to be playing these seven-inning doubleheaders, which honestly I don't mind that much, goes back to a claim by the league that they made during the negotiation process that, look, we got to get it in before it gets too cold because there'll be a second wave of coronavirus. Now, we haven't gotten off the first wave of coronavirus, and so I'm not actually sure that it would. I mean, I'm sure the TV deals, this would be a whole thing that would have to work out. You know that better than I do. But like, wait a week. There's no reason to necessarily get the postseason done by the end of October. Now, originally, when those negotiations between the league and the Players Association started, we were talking about, will we play in neutral sites if we play into November or even December? I mean, that was originally when the season was postponed and before we knew that the number of games was going to become such a contentious issue, we were talking about, all right, how are we going to play baseball once it gets colder? And then they cited health and safety as a concern for playing past October because it would get cold and the virus would spike again. But they're already playing through such an incredible outbreak all over the country. I mean, you know, 60,000 people are testing positive every day, that I think that they could build in a buffer time and just play a little later in the year.
All right. We'll see what goes. Thanks, Hannah.
Thanks, Buster.
Todd Radom is the chief executive of our weekly quiz. He's a graphic artist whose work can be seen on ball fields all across America, all around the world. Or you can go to his website at toddradom.com. And Todd, I'm super jealous because before we got started, you told me that while you had been out of power earlier in the week, you've got yours back. What's up with that?
I don't know, Buster. A divine act of providence returned electricity to my abode last night at about yesterday afternoon at about 5:30. And all is well with the world over here. You're more than welcome to come plug in, relax. You can actually have a cold one, you know, whatever you need. But it's an amazing contrast. And again, in the scheme of things, in a very complicated world where there's a lot going on, a little perspective, but I'm happy to be back in business.
Absolutely. All right. Before we get to this week's quiz, let's talk about the ballparks in Texas. An interesting history there. Of course, the ballpark that they were supposed to open this year, Globe Life Park in Arlington. I know you haven't been there. At least I assume you haven't been there. You didn't walk around with a hard hat or something like that. What can you tell us about the new ballpark?
Well, a couple of things, Buster. I did see on Twitter a couple of weeks ago, somebody, I wish I knew who it was, mentioned that each of the Rangers' three different stadiums made their MLB debut during shortened seasons, 1972, 1994, and of course the pandemic year of 2020, which is interesting. But I actually was out there last summer, and I got a preview of the new ballpark within the old ballpark. They had kind of a preview center of what the place was going to look like in terms of materials and views. And I did some work with the Rangers last year. So anyway, you know, the look of it has been roundly castigated, right? I mean, we've seen this aerial view that's been ridiculed. But listen, unless you're arriving via your own personal aircraft, it's not what you're going to see when you enter the ballpark, right? So when I was down there last year, I think the look is a little bit more organic. It's certainly not intimate. It's a giant, giant place. There are Texas-style flourishes throughout in terms of the materials, you know, materials that look like barn wood and local stone and brick and that kind of thing. Doesn't have the kind of curb appeal that the previous ballpark had. And we'll pivot back and forth to the old place and the one before that. But a couple of points about the new place. The outfield dimensions commemorate the Rangers' retired uniform numbers. For example, it's 329 to left in honor of Adrian Beltre's number 29. How about that?
Wow. I like that.
That's kind of cool, right? The place cost $1.2 billion. Everything's bigger in Texas, right? And amazingly, it's completed in 30 months. Have you ever had construction going on at your house, Buster?
Yeah, I know exactly where you're going with this.
30 months is pretty amazing. The roof is made of a lightweight, high-tech, transparent material. So it really does have a different look than, for example, you know, the Diamondback Stadium. You know, again, it's this immense place with a retractable roof. It's never going to be intimate, but at least we'll have some light coming in there. And we've seen this on broadcast. And I think one of the most interesting things that all of us have taken note of is the very luxe seating right behind home plate, a dining experience that can be seen by millions on broadcast. That'll be something to eat there, right?
Yeah, and maybe I'll get the opportunity when we do that. I actually can't wait to see this ballpark. I know I saw all the criticism you referenced about how the look from the sky. I don't care. I'm just glad they have a roof on that place, because I got to tell you, the ballpark at Arlington was the most miserable place, I think, not only for media members to go and cover a game, but it had to be for players. Like when I first was covering the American League in 1995, covering the Orioles, you know, you'd go there and, you know, the players would go out for early batting practice and then they'd take regular batting practice. And that was because that's the way they always did it, Todd. And then by the last years, the Rangers were in the ballpark at Arlington. Nobody would take batting practice in the afternoon. Some, you know, occasionally maybe some guys would go out and do some work. But for the most part, they did their work inside, because somebody figured out that being out in 100 degrees every day during the summertime might not be good for players. I remember a Sunday night game that we did in Arlington, and it was 106 degrees in the first pitch. And I stayed down in the runway where the air conditioning was, down where Ron Washington used to stand, as long as I could. And I went out and there was a delay. And so within 3 minutes, of course, I am pouring sweat. And the makeup person who's there is like, you know, you're sweating. And I'm like, yeah, well, it's 106 degrees and I'm in a suit. What do you want me to say? But yeah, I mean, if any ballpark besides Arizona needs a roof, it's the ballpark in Arlington.
Yeah, let me tell you, I was down there last August, middle of August, and like I said, I did some work with the Rangers, and my friends down there were very happy to show me every nook and cranny of the stadium that was about to be replaced, and I was there for a Sunday day game, August 17th or whatever it was, so I'm down on the field, no BP for the reasons you just referenced. But I wasn't even doing anything particularly strenuous, Buster, like taking batting practice. But, you know, it's Texas in the summer, and that's what you're going to get. We talk about utility for your purposes. The utility of this new stadium will be a much welcome relief. I'll also say, as we bounce around here briefly, the two hottest stadiums I have ever been to in my life was the aforementioned experience last year there, and the old Arlington Stadium, before that place bit the dust in the early 90s, went there for a game in July in the early 90s. And it was just, you know, it's Northeast Texas in the summer.
With bleacher seats, right? With the aluminum bleacher seats. I can't even imagine how hot that was.
Uncovered without really, you know, very lacking in amenities. That place was a former minor league stadium that had been expanded after the Washington Senators moved to Texas in 1972 in the parking lot of the current ballpark. And then, you know, just lastly, we do talk about a sense of place. And I mentioned the expression curb appeal. Globe Life Park, I get the names confused a little bit, but the previous Rangers ballpark that closed last year was really a gem from the outside. There's a lake, and the architecture was very heroic and Texan. And you had all of these relief carvings on the outside with the history of Texas and Lone Stars all over the place. It really, you know, even if it wasn't in the middle of a city, it was kind of an unmistakable and very attractive place. It's still there, by the way, just not for Major League Baseball. And of course, you've got Jerry World, the home of the Dallas Cowboys, right there in spitting distance.
Yeah, and a final tip of the cap on the ballpark that they used to play in, 1995 All-Star Game, the year that Cal Ripken broke Lou Gehrig's record. The All-Star Game was there, and Cal stood out in that heat. And I remember it was over 100 degrees. He stood out in that heat for I'm guessing something in the range of an hour to 2 hours signing autographs, which was what Cal did that year. All right, wow. Let's get to this week's quiz.
All right, guys, here we go. Buffalo. It's been in the baseball news lately, so I've got a Buffalo question this week. This Hall of Fame pitcher was born in Buffalo. And here's a hint. He won his 300th game in a Braves uniform. Was it A, Greg Maddux, B, Tom Glavine, C, Warren Spahn, or D, Cy Young? Buffalo born, 300-game winner in the major leagues, won his 300th in a Braves uniform. Maddux, Glavine, Spahn, or Cy Young?
Wow. What do you got there, Taylor?
Oh, boy. Let's go Spahn. No reason.
Man, see, that was my choice, and I was getting now I'm like, you know what? I got to make up some ground. We're running out of days. I'm going to be on vacation next week. You know what? I'll just for a shakeup, I'm going to go Cy Young.
Warren Spahn.
Yes. Yeah. Let's go.
Yeah. Warren Spahn, born in Buffalo.
So. Yeah, that's what I thought. Whatever.
There, Buster. Just a stupid quiz on a dumb podcast.
All right.
No big deal.
Thanks, Todd.
Hey, Buster, I hope you get your power back soon. Thanks.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Friday. First up, our guy at Kaya King Smith writes in, so Buster, what's more impressive? That a man who opted out, missed portions of summer camp and the first 2 weeks of the season, hit a walk-off first pitch home run off a slider, or that Nick Markakis smiled after he did that?
Yeah, it's an incredible moment when Nick Markakis smiles. So that is the most impressive thing of that moment.
Oh, man. Greek God, Nick Markakis. Love that guy. PK Steinberg up next. Do you think there is reluctance on the part of the Phillies to sign Real Muto because the contract he'll deserve will really hamstring them for the pitching they so desperately need?
No, I don't. PK, I think that you know, they had started some conversations in spring training. I think that if not for the COVID shutdown, they would have reached an agreement before the end of spring training. But like a lot of teams, they're kind of wondering where the dust is going to settle on the free agent market. I would say this, by not signing him before he gets to the market, they risk the possibility of losing him to another team. And the first team that comes to mind are the Mets, because they're going to have new ownership. And I think it's going to be aggressive ownership. And JT is going to be one of the two or three best free agents.
Last one for the week, Ryan J. Southworth, a new name I've seen in the Bleacher Tweets here. He writes in, Buster, really enjoy the podcast. I've noticed that we always hear about numbers of players who test positive, but I've not seen follow-up on how serious these infections are. Of those infected, do we know how many were hospitalized versus asymptomatic and then maybe somewhere in between?
Yeah, I look, in a lot of cases, that information is being kept private. For example, Tommy Hotovy, the Cubs pitching coach, we didn't know till after the fact, after he recovered, how serious his illness was. And he was in the hospital and they're very worried about him. I'm sure that as time goes on, we're going to learn more about those cases. Most of the time we hear asymptomatic. I think the most serious one that I've heard of last weekend, the Red Sox announcing that Eduardo Rodriguez is done for the year because his inflammation in his heart related to it. And all you have to do is watch the video of Freddie Freeman talking about how his temperature spiked, how scared he was, how nervous he was about, as his temperature went up to 104.5 degrees. But for the most part, you hear that it's asymptomatic.
Alrighty, that does it for Bleacher Tweets for the week. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. Subscribe, rate, and review to this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. And if, say, you're going on vacation next week and you haven't listened to all the shows this week, good time to do that, Buster. Anything to share with the listening audience?
Yeah, and I'm going on vacation next week. I'm very excited about that.
Where to?
Someplace in upstate New York. I'm going to Lake George. My family, we all rent the same place every year for 2 weeks, and I'll be doing the podcast in 2 weeks, but next week I'm off. So thanks for carrying the ball during that time.
Absolutely. We got Tim Kirkshin on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and then David Schoenfield on Tuesday and Thursday. So we'll shake it up a little bit. We'll hold down the fort, and we eagerly await your return.
That's it for today. That's it for this week's. My thanks today to Steve, to Hannah, to Todd, and to Taylor. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something we need to fight against every single day.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.